Shalom, welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians, and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this, all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or follow and like Inspiration from Zion and the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where, as always, we're going to offer you an exciting opportunity. And please feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. Today is a long overdue, and I know we're still some months away before Yom Kippur, when we're supposed to make amends for failings of the past year. But I realized in reaching out to our guest, Rabbi Ken Spiro, it's my bad that we have had him. This is the first time he's appearing on Inspiration from Zion, but I'm really grateful. I just reached out because I wanted to have a conversation this week, specifically about Passover, which is coming up next week, but also in the context of the last 6+ months in the war that we are not just experiencing, but still very much in the midst of. Let me introduce him. I've always had a great deal of respect and admiration for Rabbi Spiro. He's a senior lecturer and researcher at Eish HaTorah here in Jerusalem. And in addition, he's a licensed tour guide with Israel's Ministry of Tourism. Rabbi Spiro graduated from Vassar College with a BA in Russian language and literature, and then did graduate studies at the Pushkin Institute in Moscow. That I did not know. And actually, I want to get into that for a little bit today. He has a master's in history from the Vermont College of Norwich University and rabbinic ordination from Yeshiva Eish HaTorah here in Jerusalem. He's appeared on numerous radio and TV programs, such as the BBC Radio and TV, National Geographic Channel, the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, Channel 4 England, and Arutz Sheva here in Israel, the Israel National Radio. He's the author of World Perfect, The Jewish Impact on Civilization, and Crash Course in Jewish History and this is the third book, there's a comma missing, Destiny, Why a Tiny Nation Plays Such a Huge Role in History. His writings and seminars can be accessed at his website, www.kenspiro.com. Rabbi Spiro was born and raised in the U.S. and has lived here in Israel since 1982. He served as a combat infantry unit in the IDF. He's the father of 5 children and currently lives in Jerusalem. One of the things that's really interesting, and it comes out from the bio, Rabbi Spiro is more than a pundit. He's actually a very deep thinker, and that's why his list of credits in terms of media and the books is not just news sites, but actually people and places and websites that are digging in deep, and I think we're going to get into that today. Rabbi Spiro, long overdue, but welcome to Inspiration from Zion.
Thanks, Jonathan. Great to be here, finally.
Yeah, finally. Yeah, you didn't know what you were missing, but now you will.
Exactly.
So here we go. I have a question for you. I did not know that you studied Russian language. I sure did not know that you studied the Pushkin Institute in Moscow. We're more or less contemporaries, which means whenever it was that you were doing that, we were young men and Jews were still penned up in the Soviet Union. And most of us in that generation were fighting in one way or another for their freedom. Tell me about that. What years were you in Moscow and what was that like?
It's actually perfect you asked that, because we're talking about Pesach and the theme is let my people go. And that was the theme of the Soviet Jewry movement.
Correct.
Let people go, 100%. So I went and I studied, just a little more background than that. I studied in college. I wanted to do international business. So I studied foreign languages thinking that would be useful. In my case, it was Russian and Japanese. Today it would be Spanish and Mandarin. And after 7 years studying Russian in high school and college, I could read Tolstoy's War and Peace in the original Russian.
Wow.
But I couldn't ask for directions on a street, because if you want to, I always say, you want to speak a language, you got to live there. Want to learn Spanish? Go move to Florida. So I decided So I got into business school and I deferred for a year. By the way, I come from a completely non-observant home. We used to have the joke of speaking about Passover again. People ask me, my son asked me that years ago, what does that mean, non-observant? He said, what did you used to do, like Jewish stuff when you were little? And I said, on Passover, we used to have ham and cheese on matzah.
I, by the way, I can relate to much of what you're saying.
He laughed. He goes, Dad, why'd you bother with the matzah? I said, it was Passover. We're not allowed to have leavened bread, you know? So anyway, I decided to take a year off and spend the first half of that year as a graduate student in the Soviet Union at the time, and then to go to kibbutz for half a year.
And what year was that?
That was in, I graduated from Vassar in June of 1981. So I went in the fall of August of 1981. I went to the Soviet Union to the University of Moscow, Pushkin Institute for teaching teachers how to teach Russian, which I was not interested in. But when it was the Soviet Union, you couldn't just show up. Like you or I could pop on a plane and go to France and get a 3-month tourist visa. In Russia, there's no such thing. If you
Correct.
wanted to go visit Russia as a tourist, you get 1 week in tourist tour. You
Correct.
know, they keep you on a bus with KGB watching you everywhere. So if you want to get immersion, the only way to do it for me was as a student. So that turned out to be, I wasn't at all interested in my graduate degree in Russian language. I just wanted the immersion. So skipping classes was not an issue. And I ended up actually skipping a lot of my classes and hanging out with hundreds of young Russian Jews. This was when it was illegal for those of us who are old enough to remember the Soviet Union, which is sometime from today till after we left Egypt. It was, until 1989, basically. It was illegal for in the communist Russia suppressed all religions, but all faiths. Christianity was also suppressed, but tolerated. Judaism was basically totally suppressed.
Correct.
There was a few
Because
of, yeah.
it wasn't just the religion, which was very hard, because also we had line 5 of their internal passports listed your nationality. So they didn't typically discriminate against Georgians or Ukrainians or Tatars and others. But when your internal passport said Jew, that was
Right.
even though it went against the Soviet system, they discriminated against us widely.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. There was open discrimination against Jews. Remember, at that time, Soviet Union, which encompassed far more than Russia, it was Ukraine and White Russia, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, all these countries. That was the one of the three largest Jewish communities in the world, along with Israel and the
Correct.
United States. There was millions of Jews in that place, who went through a unique combination of something that's actually unprecedented in Jewish history. If you talk about the Passover story, it says that having lived in Egypt for a couple hundred years, first as free people, then as slaves, we basically had assimilated largely. There's a famous rabbinic statement that besides our clothing, our names, and keeping the Hebrew language, we're basically as Egyptian as anyone else. I'm a historian, and what was interesting about Russia is generally one of the side benefits, I'm saying that sarcastically, of anti-Semitism is it tends to keep Jews Jewish.
Correct.
And it did have an effect of doing that, but because Jews were so gutted of their Judaism, because what keeps Jews Jewish is the ability to live and learn as a Jew, and that was denied Jews. There was no books, there was no Hebrew schools. All that was illegal. You get arrested for trying to study or practice Judaism.
Or even teach Hebrew, or even teach Hebrew.
Yeah, absolutely. I had to suffer through because I was raised Reform. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's like the most liberal version of Judaism that appeared in the early 19th century, which was basically originally created to allow Jews to assimilate comfortably into, at that time, German culture. So we had to go to after school Hebrew school, which I always say, Jonathan, was one of the worst ideas ever thought up in Jewish history. It was clearly designed by an anti-Semite to destroy any love you had for your faith.
We are survivors.
Survivors of after school. We're actually miraculous that you and I are connected Jewishly and living in Israel is almost as unlikely as winning the lottery, having gone to after school Hebrew school. But I used to try and do anything I could to get thrown out of after school Hebrew school. Such a meaningless, boring, horrible experience. And then I spend half a year in Russia with people who are risking their lives
Yes,
to
right.
try and do like secret Hebrew school. And it wasn't like, and secret Hebrew school was pretty wild. There was no classroom like Hebrew school, congregation of, Beth El of Moscow. It was done in people's houses or one-on-ones. There was no books, and you didn't write any notes down because the KGB, which was the Russian secret police, the Soviet secret police, caught you with anything in Hebrew, written in Hebrew. You could lose your job, you get beaten up, you go to jail. It was really dangerous. So it was like Anyone knows that book by Ray Bradbury, Fahrenheit 451, where they're suppressing literature and burning books. So
Indeed.
people had a job of memorizing an entire book. Everything you learned, you had to memorize.
That's right.
So this is like the ultimate, you know, the best way to learn anything, as the rabbi says, you know, lilmod al manat lilamed, you learn in order to teach. This was really like on steroids. So
Indeed.
these people, like, more or less, I would say necessarily risking their lives, but risking a heck of a lot to study and practice Judaism.
Yes.
It was an unbelievable experience. The first Shabbat I ever had, was real Shabbat I ever had, was in Moscow. It was a
That's
legal time
amazing.
of Shabbat.
That's
The
amazing.
first
Yeah.
Sukkot I ever went to was in sneaking outside Moscow, which is illegal for foreigners to go to a Sukkot. Visit, you know, all these, and these people were really, it was an unbelievable experience. Really,
Yeah, that
really.
my Soviet Jewry activism began when I was a teen. I guess I'm a few years younger than you are, but I realized then, and then through my first trip to the Soviet Union when I was 20 in 1985, also on an in-tourist trip, but I was traveling alone. I was a student traveling alone on this organized tour with Natasha, the in-tourist guide slash KGB representative, who did not like at all that I was leaving the trip more than not, to go, and I don't remember what lie I had made up where I was going, and but it had something to do with my interest in Soviet culture, a funny oxymoron. And what you don't know about me is that in order to prepare for this, because I had adopted a family in Moscow and I had written my college essays about how I was going to get them out, and even within half an hour of meeting them in July of 85, I had proposed marriage to the oldest daughter in order to get her an illegal U.S. marriage, which could have had me in jail in America, not to mention in the Soviet Union as well. I'll send you afterward, or people who are interested can look up the video of after they got out. The ABC News made me Person of the Week in March of 1985, 88, when they got out, and she actually came and was accepted to Emory. I made Emory University part of my ploy in order to get the family out, and they did, in a year that only fewer than 900 Jews got out. But unlike you, I taught myself Russian in order to be able to get around, because I couldn't travel around Moscow without with nothing. So I could read the signs. I knew which directions I was going, and you'll probably know exactly. I mean, you know the underground metro in Moscow, but I once got lost there and had good enough Russian to go to somebody and say, "Пожалуйста, где проспект Мира?" And then she answered me in Russian, and I had to say, "Нет, нет, нет, английский." And she was able to point me in the right direction. But fascinating. It's for another conversation. And it's fascinating. And unfortunately, our children and grandchildren don't have that experience, but we're in a different experience that we're going to get to, and relates to the Soviet Jews, relates to Pesach, Passover. But before we do, I wanted to look at Passover with you in light of the war that we have been living through in the last six and a half months. With Passover next week, everything's changed. This morning, as I was driving home, I thought, my goodness, it's sort of like being in mourning. When you lose a parent or a loved one, your life changes, right? And you can recover from that. Grief and mourning stay with you, but I think our life has changed forever, and Passover will always have different meanings and different associations. Forget the fact that the second day of Passover is when we observe the memorial of our neighbors, Lucy and Maya and Rena D, who were murdered a year ago by terrorists in the Jordan Valley. What's your overall takeaway before we talk about Passover in general and what's different this year? What's your overall takeaway about how we're looking at life differently here in Israel as a result of the war?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question. You know, our historical experience, we Jews have been through so much. It's amazing we're as functional as we are. It really is, because going all the way back to Egypt till today, the world has been beaten on us really hard. This is not the first time we have gone through this. But it seems to me the what has changed in terms of the energy within the country. First of all, I think, even though we live in the worst neighborhood, I don't know how, Jonathan, how many years you've been here. I've been in
This
Israel.
year's 20.
Okay, I've been 42 years in Israel, and I only came for 3 months. So I stayed a little longer. So I've been through a lot, you know, from the first Lebanon War in 1982 all the way through today, and multiple wars in Gaza. You know, I was in the army; I had my kids fighting in Gaza multiple times, including this war. But things we, on one hand, we bounce back very quickly. On the other hand, I think the Yiddish expression is shpilkas, which is not really being settled. There's a certain unease that has kind of filtered into the country about. Really, you know, I didn't live here in the early years of the state when things were really tough, when they were rationing everything and there was constant terrorism, and the Israeli military was nowhere near what it is today. And again, I think we've demonstrated, especially what happened, you know, just 2 nights ago with, you know, intercepting all those missiles. You know, thank God we have the best missile defense system in the world. But I think that in many ways, the population of Israel has collectively found itself in a level of discomfort that I don't think we have been in since probably the October 1973 war, which was the last time I think we felt there was a real existential threat. Because it wasn't just what happened on October 7th, which I remember very, we all remember very well. It's like one of those events, like 9/11. You remember exactly where you were and what you were doing. The human nature that time dulls all pain. So life has gone back to normal. To a certain extent, even though that war is still going on, and even though we still have, you know, it's over 100, but who knows how many are alive, people still being held hostage in Gaza. But my sense is just that people are feeling that something has really shifted in the country and where we're going, and we're not going to go back to the same set. It's almost a complacent way that we get along with life here, even though we live in the most dangerous neighborhood in the world. People are a little bit more like awake, which is a good thing, and conscious about certain things, especially things like unity and disunity. Anyone who watches videos from the army or drives in the street in Israel, everything, it's Yachad Ninatzeh, you know, together we will be victorious. It's everywhere. It's on every sign, every store
Right.
has this. So, you know, the country was ripping itself apart prior to October 7th. So I think there's a general, I think, increase in people's feeling that we cannot go back to the infighting and tearing ourselves apart, which is unfortunately a sad pattern in Jewish history, which always precedes great external threats. This is one of the things I speak about as a historian who wears a rabbi hat and a historian hat, because we believe, you know, it's not called his story for nothing. All of human history is an interaction between the things we do, sensible or stupid, and God's infinite knowledge and control of everything. So this interplay, we do dumb things, we pay the consequence. Sometimes it comes through seemingly natural phenomenon, but it's always a byproduct of how we're behaving. We were behaving very badly before October 7th. So I think people are aware of that, but it just seems to, I'm just speaking for myself. And I just think that people are, we didn't slide back into, I wouldn't say going to sleep, but being comfortable the way we were before. A, because the situation hasn't ended. It's only
Right.
ramped up. The threats are still on the horizon everywhere. What happened 2 days ago was really quite historic. That this is an open attack. It's a total act of war. Happens to be the surreal aspect of living in Israel is because we have such this amazing missile defense system. We could go on with life, more or less normally. Any other country, look at Ukraine. Look what's going on in Ukraine. It's a perfect example. They get the same Iranian drone shot at them, power plants blown up, buildings destroyed, hundreds of people killed. The country's being trashed slowly. And we're like, yeah, no problem. So there's definitely just this different energy in the air. That's what I think. I'm sure you probably feel the same way.
Oh, I think you're right. I've been using a phrase when I'm in doing interviews myself and speaking. I say that the DNA of our soul has changed. And a professor of mine from college, Dr. David Blumenthal, when I visited him at the beginning of my most recent US trip and book launch tour, he shared with me that there's a word for that. And we know the word, we know the phenomena. It's called epigenetics, which relates to how, which most commonly known in terms of Holocaust survivors, children of Holocaust survivors, even grandchildren, that we pass along the traumas. And matter of fact, yesterday I was with my 3-year-old grandson who said to me, Saba, we had a siren last night, or yeah, I saw him yesterday. We had a siren last night and I cried. And I asked him why he cried. We had a conversation about that. I told him we also had a siren, which seemed to make him feel a little bit more at ease. But I wonder, is this, he's a 3-year-old. Is this, of course, the war is not over, and yet there may be more trauma, but how is this going to impact a 3-year-old? for the rest of his life, for the next 70, 80, or 90 years. It's crazy. These are great conversations. I want to take a quick break and then come back and jump into the holiday and see how we're looking at it differently.
As remarkable and miraculous as Israel is, and its very existence a testimony to God's faithfulness, in many ways, Israel's like most other countries. Just as there are parents anywhere who have stronger and weaker parenting abilities, and adults become a product of situations in their lives that they cannot control, making their ability to raise and care for their own children even harder, that's true in Israel as well. The Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation is committed and takes the mandate seriously to care for the least of these, our brothers, our children. We're committed to bless and strengthen orphans and at-risk youth, to invest in them, to empower them, so that their future will be brighter than their past or their present. But Israel is unique in that there are always threats of war and terror which know no bounds. For children who come from homes that are not safe, sometimes the very scary reality of living in a community that's not safe is too much to bear. We are committed to turning orphans and at-risk youth into children of promise. We fund a variety of programs to help those most in need as widely as we can. We invite and encourage you to join us today so that we can ensure their brighter tomorrow. Please visit genesis123.co to find out more and to send your love and most generous donation today.
Okay, Rabbi Spiro, I love this conversation. We could go on in so many different directions. Now that I've opened the door, we'll have you back and we'll pick lots of other interesting topics for the future. Passover is here, right? As we speak, people are getting crazy cleaning their homes and cleaning the Cheerios out from underneath the car seats and getting ready for Seder. And in the back of many of our heads is the wonder, well, what's going to happen? Are we all going to be, is everyone going to be home? If this war were to escalate, our sons and some of our daughters going to be called up to Lebanon and to Gaza and wherever. And I wanted to jump in to how we're looking at Passover. And just before we began the conversation, I realized, you know, I said to you offline that the question is, what's different this year? How are we looking at things different? And that jumps into, for those not familiar with the traditional Jewish Passover Seder, we ask four questions. Why is this night different from all other nights? And this year, I think, is that question. Why? How?
Yeah, absolutely. We're the people who there's a great quote from Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, who is a professor at Columbia University. He did a series of lectures, which was turned into a small book called Zachor, which means remember in Hebrew. It actually says in the book of Deuteronomy, Zachor Yemot Olam, you should remember the past. You know, and ask your elders and your parents, and they'll tell you. Yerushalmi actually makes a great comment. He says Herodotus, who was a Greek who wrote almost 2,500 years ago, he said he's the father of history in the West, the first person to start really recording history. We always assume people always recorded history. It's not true. But he said if Herodotus is the father of history, the father of meaning in history are the Jews. It's a beautiful insight. That we are, because we are the people who brought the idea of one infinite intelligence, a perfect infinite being that is outside the physical universe, yet interacts with his creation, means that history is a control process leading to a destination. Now we're in a story, and we Jews have always understood that, you know, this idea of chosenness, we're not chosen for any privilege. We're chosen for unique responsibility to basically reconnect humanity with God and bring God-given values and worldview, spirituality, morality that comes from that God to the collective consciousness of humanity. That's kind of the national historic mission of the Jewish people. But coming along with that idea that there's a God who acts in history, which is an idea which, by the way, the ancient Greeks like Herodotus would have found ridiculous. Why would a perfect being interact with an imperfect creation? Go read Plato for more on that. Comes this idea that you have to not only remember history, but there's meaning in history. You know, other people's holidays like 4th of July are just commemorations of past historical events. Our understanding of holidays and history, especially holidays that we're not into so much holy space, we're into holy time. Time has energy. You can tap into it.
Yes.
Like the Sabbath, which is an acquired taste, the day when you refrain from creative labor, but you can refocus on spirituality. And as I say, with all puns intended, rejuvenate is a unique period of time of energy. You can't do the other 6 days of the week. So too, the holidays have themes. It's more than just Passover has kind of become kind of a universal holiday. I mean, in the White House, everyone, all the presidents have Passover Seders. And it fits kind of well into the American.
But universal is also a good word because they've made it universalist, but it's really not.
Exactly. It's turned into the holiday of freedom. Even if you read about the history of this, you know, slavery in America, and you have these songs like when Israel was in Egypt land, let my people go, go down Moses, let my people go. The song we sing, you know, that became, if you look at the imagery and the words of a lot of the songs sung by slaves in America, it's all about that. Correct. You look about how the, you know, even the pilgrims who came to America in the 17th century viewed themselves as reenacting the Exodus narrative. And Europe was Egypt, and Pharaoh were like the kings of Europe, and the Atlantic Ocean was crossing the sea in America. Plymouth Rock was literally the new Mount Sinai. So this theme has been universalized by the world for many, many hundreds of years. But we understand that on a deeper level, that the energy that's embedded in Passover is, first of all, it's not only about freedom, it's about free will, you know, which is the most godlike trait that all humans have. The ability to make, taking responsibility and choosing is the greatest thing every human being does. We are the sum total of the decisions we make and the responsibility we take. And we Jews, you know, as a people with this unique mission, it's all about focusing on how we're going to use the freedom that we got. You know, we thank God on Passover for taking us out of Egypt, but he put us in there in the first place because we Jews understand it's not like bad comes from the devil and good comes from God. The good, the right. Bad, it's infinite creator of the universe. When we hear someone's died, my father passed away 4.5 months ago. The first thing out of my mouth was Baruch Dayan Emet. Blessed is, you know, the truthful judge.
Right.
That whatever God does is ultimately for the good, even though we don't necessarily see it. But we understand that there's, when we're going through that Passover Seder, first of all, we do every year, as you mentioned, one of the commandments is to tell the story of Passover, even though you know it many times. By the time you get to our age, we've heard this. We've been doing this since we're little kids. But you have to constantly remember. You have to constantly remember and recharge our memory so that we refocus on our mission, which is that God puts us in to take us out, to not just give us a passport and a credit card and say, here, go be free and do whatever you like, but to bring us as a nation to a specific piece of real estate for a specific mission. And a lot of that is even lost on a lot of Jews who've also made the holiday about an excuse to eat a lot of food and tell a story. And it's kind of cutesy and quaint, but if you actually focus on it, it's very powerful. And there are certain themes within Passover that are so important. And I think will really be at this, based on what we've gone through at the beginning of our yearly holiday cycle is basically Sukkot. And then you get the Passover at the end, these long holidays. And then we have a little bit later, 50 days after, we're going to have Shavuot. But where we are in our Jewish life cycle and our learning cycle and our rejuvenating educational cycle is focusing on certain ideas. And if you read the Passover Haggadah, there's certain things in that I think are really, really, really going to resonate. Number one, no doubt in my mind, is, you know, you talk about epigenetic trauma. We have been through so much as a people. I mean,
we're in the midst of
it. And it doesn't end. There's no people that can hold, you know, I don't want to go into who's having a competition or who suffered more, but hands down, the Jewish people have suffered more as a nation for longer under the hands of more people, more profoundly and violently and more irrationally than any people in human history. There is no argument about that. I can show you anti-Semitism going back to Abraham in the Bible, in like 3,700 years ago. But one of the things we do on the Passover Seder is we raise our cup. And we say, you know, because there's the whole idea of cups and freedom, and there's four cups and the fifth cup about redemption. It's very ritualized and meaningful, the whole Seder. But we say, Behisha Amda. In every generation, Amdu Alina Chalatina. Someone has stood up to try and destroy us. But God has saved us from their hands. And no question in my mind of all the holidays that we're going to go through since October 7th, I think you're going to have more collective consciousness and awareness of how precarious our existence is. And we were talking about this before, about we're kind of shaken out of the comfort zone we are in, even though we live in such an uncomfortable part of the world, the Middle East, we were able to maintain such a level of normal existence. thanks to the big guy upstairs and the Israeli army and our great missile defense system. But people are really just more on edge. And that edge, and I think that has, you talked about epigenetics. I think that's really shaken up our epigenetic core. Because, yeah. Jonathan, what's interesting, Malcolm X, you know, who is the head of the, you know, the black, you know, the Muslim, you know, the black Muslim movement in America in the 60s, he was murdered. He wrote a great autobiography, and he's a very intelligent guy. I think if he had lived longer, he would have opened up much more to Judaism and been a lot more tolerant.
Well, that's
just speculation. I think he would have. He was really going through a big process before he was murdered. But he had something I always remember when I read that. He said no matter what audience he was in, even if he was blindfolded, he was one of the most sought after speakers in the mid 60s in America. He's a real radical guy. He said he could always tell when a Jew was asking him a question.
Really?
Because he said they were so hypersensitive. Like there's that joke, you know, did you eat yet? You know, like, you know, did you eat yet? Say it fast. It's like the word Jew is in there. What do you mean? So, but it's really interesting. There's this kind of epigenetic level of trauma that is so embedded, especially in Ashkenazic Jews like you and I, who are the European Jews who went through far more trauma than the Sephardic Jews, the Middle Eastern Jews, and I think that's really been poked. It's like having a sore muscle that you don't feel except when you move your foot in the wrong way, or you have like something in your body that's really sensitive to pain when you poke it, like you hit the elbow and like, ooh, ow. So I think people really are going to appreciate that. As amazing it is that we have a Jewish state, which is really totally supernatural. Mm-hmm. And that we have a refuge that we have for half the Jews in the world now, when in 1939, there was no place for us to go. We're still, our existence is very precarious. Mm-hmm. And Passover is all about God's hand in his story. And one thing you've seen in Israel, all the fighting kind of stopped. Unfortunately, I think you and I both realize it's already starting again. It's already starting again. They're using, now they're just coming from a different angle.
Wait, let me just be clear. For anyone who's not, when we're talking about the fighting now, we're not talking about the war in Gaza against Hamas or Lebanon or Iran. We're talking about domestic infighting, political squabbling, and amongst ourselves, which is definitely resurfacing. Yes,
it is. It is. So that is started up again, but people are also, and war always does this. You know that expression: "There's no atheists in the foxholes." I'm sure you can. There's a plethora of so many videos out there about soldiers singing and dancing and saying the whole Golani Brigade doing Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hero Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, before they go into battle. You know, this is like biblical. Sure, so sure. It's kind of like Dickens, you know, the Tale of Two Cities, the great novel. He says it's the best.
We're going from Malcolm X to Dickens.
I like
Tolstoy.
I like to bring in a lot of stuff. That's why I love people like Jonathan Sacks. I like people who are Renaissance people who can bring in a lot of stuff. So the beginning of the Tale of Two Cities by Dickens is the best of times and the worst of times. You know, every cloud in Jewish history has a silver lining. You know, the silver lining in the Holocaust is getting enough sympathy for the world to barely vote to partition Palestine into a Jewish and Arab state. And the silver lining in what happened is people stopped fighting and started focusing on unity, that we can win this together. But also that people are really open to spirituality, because a lot of people who may not be observant are still very religious, especially if you look at the Sephardic Jews. The Jews from the Middle East didn't go through the secularization process that Jews of Europe went through the Enlightenment and through emancipation. Correct. And through movements of Judaism that moved them away. You know, the Sephardic Jews, the synagogue they don't go to is always Orthodox. They're always only a generation away. So you see how, especially amongst the soldiers, especially, there's a really massive reawakening of you know, a desire to connect spiritually, and a recognition, which is what Passover is really all about, is that God is always, the story of Purim, which is a rabbinic holiday, it's not in the Torah, it's not in the Bible, but it's a story of a salvation of the Jewish people that takes place through seemingly completely natural means, a series of coincidences. Which is a fantastic story, which is how God generally acts behind the scenes. You know, seas don't part and plagues don't hit. But when it's all over and the, you know, the smoke clears, you see that it, like, statistically, there's no way this should have happened.
Like what we had this week.
Right. So Passover is the exact opposite. Passover is the most extreme the other way. Passover is where God intervenes more in human history than anything else we see.
Right.
Yeah,
But
destroys the. Yeah.
because we're in mourning still, because this year, and I love how you approached the Vehisha Amda with that, in every generation, someone's rising up against us to annihilate us. At this year, we're going to have tens of thousands of Israelis who are mourning their loved ones who have been killed, soldiers in battle, and the 1,200 who were slaughtered on October 7th. We are going to be experiencing what 105 people who were actually let go from slavery in Gaza are still experiencing the trauma of being hostages, as well as their families, plus the families of the 133 people dead or alive in Gaza. And then people like you and I, we didn't have the conversation yet, but you have kids and served in Gaza. I have kids and son-in-law who are in Gaza. I just realized as you're speaking, this will be only the second time since in 6 months that my whole family will be together. And how can we not say that with a profound sense of gratitude that, yeah, my son went through some really horrible things and experienced things that no parent wants their child to ever have to experience, but thank God we're all here and we're still standing, and yet some people are going to be angry at God, and some there's going to be lack of faith. I want to take a break and come back and pick this up because it's really fascinating.
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better. Much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds, just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones.
Okay, I shouldn't have taken a break because we were in a really good flow, Rabbi Spiro, but where wh what else is going to be like hitting that nerve that you said, poking us this year that's different?
Right. So we have this, you know, we have this, we have this, you know, cup of Elijah, the fifth cup you pour, which is connected with redemption, the
Wow.
messianic era, which we don't drink. And it's kind of like for the future, but it kind of sits there. When I was a little kid, I'm sure a lot, millions of Jews have done this throughout history, waiting for it to go down. You know, someone, you know, Elijah the prophet is always the one who supposedly precedes the coming of the Messiah. It says, "Behold, I will send Elijah before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord." It says it's in the prophet Malachi, Malachi. He says that at the end. I was just to see if, you know, is it going to go down at all? Who's going to drink it? But then I figured after a few years that, you know, that Passover wine is so sugary and so alcoholic. You know, he went to the Friedman's, then the Goldbergs, then the Schwartz's, the Cohen's. By the time he got to our house, he was like, he passed out on their couch. But I think what you're going to see is not a cup. A lot of Passover seders, like a lot of people are going to do this. You know, if you go to Hostage Square, which is Tel Aviv Art Museum in Tel Aviv, there's a permanently set Shabbat table with place settings for all of the hostages who are not present at the Sabbath dinner. So too Passover, which is one of the most kept rituals in the Jewish world, even for non-observant Jews. Everyone gets together. In Israel, it's something like 87% of the Jews in
Correct.
Israel have a Passover Seder. It's just something you just do it. It's such ingrained in our culture. I think there's going to be an extremely, obviously amongst families who have lost family members, who are wounded soldiers and whatever, there's so many thousands of people wounded. And obviously the hostages, they're going to be focusing on that very strongly, that this Passover, as you said, is more than probably any other event, with the only maybe Rosh Hashanah, but even Passover more so, is when a family gets together. Probably
more than anything. Oh, 100%.
Yeah. So I think that the lack of the fact that we all, even though we fight and argue because we are a family, the Jewish people, we're not just a religion, we're not just a nation, we're a nation and a religion, but we're also a family. There's a very profound sense of we're missing family members who are hostage,
100%.
And family members who are dead. And remember, in Israel, one Israeli soldier, God forbid, being killed is equivalent of over 50 American soldiers dying proportional to the population. Memorial Day here, which comes also around the same time of year, is not a shopping day, no. American day off. It's a very profound, it's unbelievable. The siren goes off and all the cars stop on the highways and everyone gets out and stands at attention. It's a very real thing. And the wound is very, very, very raw. So I think that there's going to be a lot of that's going to pervade the Passover Seder. And I'm sure it must be out there already. I haven't seen it. That they're going to be like people adding in special prayers and things to take note of and mention specifically at that time when we're all together as a nation celebrating our liberation 3,336 years ago. I think that's how many Passover Seders we have had. That's a pretty amazing thought. That maybe it's 3,337. I think this is 37 this year. That we have to remember those of us who either unfortunately not with us because of what happened, either gone from this world or still being held hostage. So I think that is, and that's going to really get into our epigenetic skin.
And we used to do that when we were young, also with the Soviet Jewry movement, setting an empty seat for our brothers and sisters who weren't able to observe. When you're talking about something fascinating just came to mind, when you're talking about Elijah's cup, which doesn't go down. We always had a thing. My father, I remember, and I do it for my grandchildren. My kids were young. When they go to open the door to let Elijah in, I quickly chug the thing so that they think actually Elijah came in. And when you have little enough people in the house, you can get away with it and it's fun. But we also have this tradition where before we say a blessing on one of the cups of wine, we dip our finger in and reduce a full cup by 10 drops. The 10 drops because of the plagues, and even we as Jews are sad for the suffering of the Egyptian people. Do you think that's, or of course it's going to be different, and it can go in a whole lot of different ways. We can be really sad for what's happening to civilians in Gaza, or we can be thinking, no, these are our enemies. I don't mean necessarily all of the Gazans, and we shouldn't be spilling a single drop of blood. In fact, of wine. What are your thoughts on how that might go?
That's a great question. That's like, it's like mixed emotions. There's like the psychological, emotional level a person should never take pleasure in suffering of another human being. Although sometimes the people are so evil, if they're gone from the world, you're going to rejoice because they're gone from the world. But I think it has to do, I feel both ways. The Hamas was, the people in Gaza elected these people. Not that everyone in Hamas in Gaza supports them, but the overwhelming majority of them do, by the way.
They do. Sure they do.
Yeah, and you see even in the territories that are not controlled by Hamas. And you could see on October 7th, the rejoicing was crazy.
Correct.
So if they're upset now and angry at them, it's only because they have to pay the price of what the people they elected.
Correct. They don't regret.
Yeah. Right. So it's not like, the poor, Israel is going out of its way to behave in a way that no army in the most difficult urban warfare situation. I mean, Stalingrad was a walk in the park compared to what Gaza is. The Battle of Stalingrad with the Nazis trying to take that city in World War One in 1941. But so no country has gone. And they're now estimating the reality is that it's less than one civilian killed for every Hamas terrorist.
Which say that again?
It's about 10 to 1, 9 to 1 or 10 to 1.
Okay.
Even though the Hamas Ministry of Health, which has about as much credibility as the Nazi Ministry
Correct.
Of Jewish Pride,
Correct.
And making up statistics, which are grossly exaggerated, the more realistic, I've done a lot of research on this, is probably saying it's a ratio of at most 1 to 1 fighters to civilians, which is phenomenally low. given how well embedded they are and that the civilian population has nowhere to run, but they have 300 to 400 miles of tunnels. So, you know, on one hand, it's like you lie in the bed you make. But on the other hand, you also don't want to get, I'm not really worried about this because we Jews don't do this. We're the only people who, you know, we're historically, I speak about this a lot as a historian. We're the only people in the world who have to be told by God in the Bible to wipe out our enemies. And we still don't do it, by the way.
And we still don't do it.
We didn't do it with the Canaanites, and they come back to haunt us because we're always trying to be more merciful than God, or to use that expression, more Catholic than the Pope. You can't be more merciful than God. You know, these are not things we can do today. We can't say we're doing things in God's name because we're in a prophecy today. There's a lot of things we cannot do. But even when we had direct connection with the creator of the universe and his prophets are telling us to do stuff, we still don't listen because it's just not in. We're talking about epigenetics. It's not in the Jewish spiritual DNA to be cruel and nasty people. The rabbis say that Jews are rachmanim, baishanim, and gomle chassidim, that we're merciful, modest, and we love kindness. And I can clearly do a whole class demonstrating that that is, not that all Jews are kind, but collectively that is our personality.
Yeah.
We're crazy, merciful, kind people, even to a fault. There's a great line by Eric Hoffer, who is an American social thinker from the mid-20th century. He said, Jews are the only people in the world who expect it to actually act like Christians. Such a great line. You know, turn the other cheek, which is not a Jewish idea.
Not a Jewish idea at all.
But we gotta take it and keep taking it. So I think, you know, on one hand, it's one thing to do things as a commemoration. You know, when you're living 3,337 years after Egypt, and you're taking a cup out, I have a feeling that had you lived through the slavery in Egypt, what was going on?
That's what I was.
You're going to be like, you know, I think.
Nah, I'm not doing that. Not doing that.
Not
this year, right? But I have a question on that because I was thinking exactly that same thing. What happens when the Egyptians started crossing the sea and the water came down crashing and Miriam starts singing in the song, right? And was reprimanded. Now, but what I'm curious and what's, I think, starkly different, tell me if I'm wrong, you're the historian and you're the rabbi, is that today, as you just said, 87% of Gazans support Hamas and what they did. They're only upset, rightly, that they're having a repercussion from that. But when God brought plagues on Egypt, it wasn't because all the Egyptians were doing something bad. It was because Pharaoh said, nah, I'm not letting you go. I refuse to recognize your God. Am I wrong in that? Is there?
I don't know. Because, you know, I know as a historian, no totalitarian stays in power when enough people, a critical mass is reached, if people say we're not taking this.
Okay.
So the Egyptian army could have said after, like, I could see them all in their chariots waiting to go. And Pharaoh's, let's go after them. And they're like, and they're looking back on smoldering remains of what is Egypt. And they're like, are you serious? I mean, right. Albeit Pharaoh's a living God and we don't appreciate the power that he has. But you know, there's something I think you have to really distinguish between, and you bring up a good point that I need to think about more myself, between there's, you know, the reality, the objective reality of a situation versus the emotional connection that we mere mortals have to it. You know, the reality is from God's perspective is, it's not like, you know, bad comes from the devil and good comes from God. So when you destroy the bad guys, they're the enemies of God. No. God's saying, these are my children and these are my children. It's like he says to the Jews when Joshua, you know, entering the land of Israel. If these people haven't chosen to leave, you wipe them out. They're my children, but I tell you, you wipe them out. This is coming from top down. But don't rejoice on it. It's not healthy. Not good for your, it's not good for your neshama, as I say, your soul, to be taking pleasure in this. You're doing it because you have to do it.
That's profound and that's relevant right now.
Yeah. You're doing it because you have to do it. But it's human nature, and Jews are just as human as anyone else, to feel as, you know, as the what you feel about something the way it is objectively. And obviously, all of the struggle, many of the struggles we have, is us struggling between our, you know, our personal bias and our subjective feelings to objectively know what is true or right. It's like smoking. I know it stinks, but I'm addicted to it. It makes me feel good when I smoke a cigarette. So I'm going to do something I know is wrong. Okay, but at least I'll admit it's wrong. I'm going to do it anyway. So I think is a really interesting, you bring up a very interesting topic. I haven't actually thought about that much, but it seems there's a lot of psychology involved in that. But I think this year, I think the opposite is true. I think people are going to be really angry and hoping they could pour out half the cup, you know, like on the guy's head. You know, I don't know. There's going to be people. The wounds are so raw. I don't think people. I don't. I think people are. But I think it's going to be a real interesting topic of conversation. A lot of people are going to have that. You bring that up. That's very interesting. I think a lot of people are going to be thinking, should we be thinking about the people in Gaza? Who, by the way, are, you know, they got displaced. A lot of their houses are trash, but they ain't starving to death.
Well, not according to the UN.
I've heard they've gotten. Yes. No, I have heard. I've heard people online showing that they have gotten more foreign aid in a few months than they get the entire year. So they're actually, you see the videos of them selling it. It's like markets. It's
right,
like
that's a good point. That's a good point.
In the 70s, you see Bangladesh with people. You haven't seen, trust me, if Hamas could put these pictures out, they would. You don't see people lying in the streets with like sunken cheeks and eyes bulging out. You haven't seen any of that. You've barely seen pictures of large rows of bodies anywhere. Because the reality is there's not that many civilians.
Don't say that too loud. You might give them an idea. And then they'll all get up and go.
They know it. Believe me. They've put up plenty of fake pictures.
Yeah.
Let
me begin to wrap up because, again, I not only did I not script this, so nor did you, but I really didn't even make notes. I just wanted to see where this conversation would go. And you know, Passover is 8 days. We can be, well, 7 days here. We can be having this conversation for 8 days, and maybe these conversations will pop up organically, or maybe people listening to this conversation will be a catalyst for other conversations at people's Passover celebration. But one of the things that we do looking to the future, we talk about, there's two places where kids play a big role. We talk about the four kinds of children, the four sons, and questions that the kids ask, which goes into, of course, why we say, why is this night different from all other nights? And the question today on this episode is, why is this Passover different from all the Passovers? I want to know if you could take the kind of projecting forward. How are we addressing this both internally with our children? I don't mean just our biological children, but the Jewish family. And then externally, because as I'm thinking about it, you've got so many people who are just wicked out there saying evil, that the Gazans are starving, that there's a famine, that there's a genocide, that there's which is the suckiest genocide in the world. We're really bad at genocide, if that's what this is. How would you project those four things where we're looking forward, we're empowering our children to be part of the story? How do we, what's the message internally and what's the message externally?
Yeah, so I think this is going to be, pedagogically speaking, one of the best Passover sages we've had in a very long time. You know, maybe not since, you know, I read these stories of people having a Seder in a concentration camp or something.
Yeah.
That's pretty heavy. I've read these stories. I read them when I'm guiding in Yad Vashem. I think that, you know, in terms of, you know, why is this night different? Everything you've been talking about, I think there are more opportunities to make the past real to the present in this Passover than I think we've had in a very long time. In terms of, again, talking about that the threats are still there, that we're all in this together. I think it's going to be a tremendous sense of unity, because one thing we learned, Pharaoh, you know, almost, you know, 3,300 plus years ago, he didn't distinguish between what kind of Jew you were in Egypt. You know, and neither did the Nazis in Auschwitz. There's only one line. So I think the fact that all the Jewish people, pretty much, especially in Israel, will all be at the same time doing the same thing, reading the same story, reliving this our historical past, kind of recharging our memory in many ways. Like we said, one is the recognition that, you know, I say, you know, Golda Meir said pessimism is an emotion the Jewish people can never afford to have. When we go back to our past and see what we've lived through, we understand that we can't be complacent, but we don't have to be pessimistic. God runs the world and all the people. I even made a t-shirt that I usually whip out at my Passover Seder. I'll send you a copy. You can post it online.
Yeah.
It says civilizations, nations, and empires that have tried to destroy the Jewish people and their status today. And it's a short list. It says Philistines gone, ancient Egypt gone, Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian, Greek, Roman, Byzantine empires gone, 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 gone. Crusaders gone, Spanish Empire gone, Nazi Germany gone, Soviet Union gone, Iran with three question marks.
Right.
And then it
says
the Jewish people, the smallest of nations with a friend in the highest of places. So nice. It's a huge seller amongst evangelical Christians, by the way. They love it. So I'm definitely going to be wearing that shirt on my Seder this year, because that's going to be, you know, from the perspective of, you know, the children interacting with the Seder, focusing on, because the kids have gone through a lot of trauma this year. Sirens a few nights ago and what's been going on. It's been really flipped upside down. but a sense of that we've been there and done that before. We'll get through it, and we'll outlast. We will outlast all these people. And I think really with children, but I think what's going to be so important, and I'm not sure everyone will be doing this, but I know I will be, is focusing on, just as we were released from Egypt with a unique mission, now God is turning up the heat, you know, because of the good and the bad. Like I said, it all comes from God. We get too complacent within a country. That's why some of the greatest explosions of anti-Semitism have happened in places where we are most like the non-Jews and most assimilated, which is counterintuitive because most hatred is driven by dislike of the difference. It's God's way of telling us, my children, you can't disappear because your role in history is too critical. Or you want to fight amongst each other and not focus on what you should be doing? So I'll send non-Jews to come attack you. So you'll wake up and realize. So I think that it's a really amazing opportunity with almost, you know, redux, you know, going, reliving some of the threats that came before in different ways, but to focus ourselves and our children on what the mission is. And we have to rededicate ourselves as a people and as a nation to getting this job done, and not to go back to fighting and disunity, but to focus on that the secular Zionist dream of just being like everyone else is never going to, was not the vision of God. And that's not what he gave us, the land of Israel. We're supposed to be a holy nation in a holy land, and try and inspire our children to recognize that everything we do in Judaism, Torah and mitzvahs, are a means to an end. And the ends is to be a role model for the world individually and collectively, and be a nation that is literally a physical nation that truly is a light to nations in every way we behave. And God knows that's what the world needs, is role models. That's the real, I think, universal message of Passover. Really should be more about that than just freedom. It's about, you know, elevating the world back to God and making the world the place that it's supposed to be.
You've made me think a lot, and I hope that a lot of people will listen to this before they have their Seder, because we need to have these profound thoughts, and they're just going to be the beginning. This year is very stark. The wound is open. You've also made me regret that we've not had a conversation here on Inspiration from Zion before, and I'm really super grateful. I hope that listeners will matter of fact, I'm going to put, it wasn't the intention, but that we'll make this a YouTube as well for people to watch. Now, before our drop date of the podcast on Thursday, but we need to have this conversation. I want to hear from people what it triggers in them, because we need to have this. We need to learn from one another and have this kind of national dialogue. Certainly among Jews who are observing the Seder the same way, more or less, for
3,337, I think, is this.
Oh, 37. We'll give or take a year or two.
A year or two.
And for our Christian friends, especially those who understand the significance of the biblical festivals, and whose epigenetics have been changed as well because of the trauma that we, the people and state that they love. Rabbi Spira, wow. Thank you for this. Way too brief a conversation. We've opened a lot of doors, and I look forward to continuing this in the future.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
That was it. See, I can say thank you very much. All right, friends, if you've stayed with us this long, always for the last 3 years, we say you deserve a reward if this conversation is not, in fact, that reward in of itself. And if you've been following Inspiration from Zion since September, when we came out with our magnificent book, Israel, the Miracle, you know that every month we're giving away a free copy. All we ask that you do is follow and like Inspiration from Zion on all the social media. And when you comment and or share the link to this, every month we're picking one person at random. You're going to receive a free copy of this stunning book, Inspiration from Zion, Israel, the Miracle, which will be a blessing to you in your home. We are always grateful. This podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. I tell people this, and I mean it. If you're ever in the area, you might overwhelm them. If you're ever in the area, pop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And also thanks to the Coyne family as well for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and the Genesis 123 Foundation are all programs are all made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue dialogue, build and building bridges. Rabbi Spiro, I either neglected to remember or didn't know that you lost your father just a few months ago. So please tell me his name. I'd like to dedicate this episode in his memory.
Okay, so it's Rafael Ben Kalman.
And his English name?
Ronald Harvey Spiro.
Robert Harney Spiro. So in memory of Rabbi Spiro's father, that this year, this is your first year without your father, your first Passover. So this should be a year of comfort on that level as well. And as we have a tradition that all of the ideas learned here will be in his merit.
Thank you.
If you'd like to sponsor a future episode in honor, memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. And we'd always love to hear your comments as part of a dialogue and invite you to send any questions as well, especially questions about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please continue to share this with others who you know will find of interest and continue to join us right here as we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics relating to Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are safe and healthy. If you're celebrating Passover, I pray that it's a joyous holiday for you and your loved ones. And I'm sending my blessings from right here in the Judean mountains. God bless you.
Hallelujah.